We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
My guest today on Keeping the Faith is Sonia Warfel from the Department of Dance at the University of Illinois. Welcome, Sonia.
Thank you, Steve.
And you're getting a Master's of Fine Arts in Dance Performance, is that right?
And choreography, yes.
And choreography.
And teaching, yes.
And you already have a bachelor's in that from New York University?
Yes, from the Tisch School of the Arts.
Ah, okay. And what interested me most about your work, as I've been reading about it on your very good website, soniawarfel.com, is the combination of feminism and dance. And I was impressed by – I might just even read what you have on your website. You say, by virtue of our collective gaze, we as a society bestow upon the beautiful young woman performer an intoxicating sexual power, a power that is creative, generative, and ultimately addictive. Though she has us in thrall, the nature of her power rests in her own exposure, an exposure that all too often renders her vulnerable to exploitation and perhaps even violence. Then you say when she matures, she will be expected to relinquish the hold she enjoys over us in exchange for the procreative power of motherhood, the nature of which is still rooted in seclusion, not unlike the separation of church and state. 21st century American society still maintains that the two powers, that of the creative and the procreative, or in the words of Simone de Beauvoir, the productive and the reproductive, cannot be held in one female body simultaneously. Through dance, music, narrative, and comedy, and within the context of third wave feminism discourse, you will ask in your thesis project, which we're going to be talking about in a minute, why not? And you quote Simone de Beauvoir at the top of this part of your website. There are women who make of themselves a nosegay, a cage of birds.
Yes, indeed. That is my thesis project.
So you've been working on this, and there's going to be a performance when we might just mention when that will be.
That'll be on March 17th. Yes, it is St. Patrick's Day, and it will be at the Canopy Club, and you can buy tickets there.
Or you can buy them online, and you have a link from
your website. From my website, yes.
Yeah. Which is?
SoniaWarfel.com.
And Warfel is spelled?
W-A-R-F, like Frank, E-L.
Now, you've been a graduate student here how long at the University of Illinois?
For an extended amount of time, actually. This is my fifth year. Generally, students in the master's program study over a course of 3 years, but I am a mother, and when I began the program, my youngest was not even in kindergarten, so I was unable to undertake a course load and assistantship that large. So I've been going part-time now, and all that remains is my thesis project.
Now, how unusual is that for you in the department, for students in the Department of Dance in the graduate school to already be a mother with children and married? And
I personally know of none other.
Well,
oh, actually, that's not true. I now have a colleague who is expecting her first.
But it's very unusual. That's one of the reasons I thought this would make an interesting program, how you've managed to combine that and then to come up with such an interesting thesis project. Tell us what a thesis project is in the Department of Dance.
Well, it is a culminating creative project. And we use the word thesis because we're investigating some sort of question about our art making. And for me, the biggest question is how do I balance these two aspects of my personality, both of which I find to be very creative, that of parenting and that of art making.
And when you wrestled with these two issues in trying to come up with this particular project, tell us a little bit of the thinking that went involved, the intellectual work.
Well, I've done a lot of reading, obviously. I have a particular interest in the resurgence of burlesque and vaudeville in America today. Actually, it's all over the world, but in particular, my gaze has been focused more on American burlesque and vaudeville. It's a huge emerging field. Some of the most interesting artists in the world are working in this, but in my opinion, in my humble opinion, in this genre. People like Julie Atlas Muse, Dirty Martini, the world famous Bob, Indigo Blue, and of course, Dita Von Teese, who is the undisputed queen of the new burlesque movement. So I was curious, why now, why this, and why these particular representations of femininity and female sexuality, these public displays?
And I would think that particularly the question is intriguing given what we've learned from feminism in the last 25, 50, 100 years.
Yes, I agree. I think there is something very interesting evolving in feminist thought right now. In particular, the notion of third wave feminism. If we consider the first wave as being that of the suffragettes and their focus on state-mandated inequalities, voting rights, property rights, abolitionism, and we consider the second wave of feminism as being that of the 60s and 70s and a focus more on social issues, reproductive rights, equal rights amendment. The third wave is in many ways a generational and chronological evolution. And the third wave has a lot of quarrel, really, with the second. And that's something that I'm sort of coming up against in my work. In particular, this idea that the second wave was perhaps focused a little too exclusively on a white, middle-class, heteronormative female experience, and that the third wavers really do embrace a much broader, polyphonous, if you will, kind of feminism.
The second wave would talk about, for example, the male gaze mm-hmm. in terms of how men were seen to be looking on women as sexual objects, whereas third wave would see that as more universal.
Or perhaps we're not focused on the man's gaze at all. Perhaps in this project we're looking at the performer's gaze at us.
Uh-huh. Tell us what's going to happen at the Canopy Club does it all have to remain a surprise?
It does not have to remain a surprise. I will give you a little bit of a teaser trailer,
right,
if you will.
Again, that's March 17, starting at 9 o'clock in Urbana, Illinois.
That's right. Well, I do say that it is we will be transforming the Canopy Club into a fantasy land. I happen to be a great admirer of the classic MGM musicals. And although I do not have the budget to create something on the scale of Busby Berkeley, I do definitely pay homage to those traditions. There will be a burlesque routine that does, in fact, include striptease, although if you can handle Sid Charisse and Singin' in the Rain, I think you can probably handle this production. although, to be fair, that dance was considered quite risque for its time.
At the time.
There will also be a little bit of body humor in tradition. There will also be tap dancing, and I happen to be a real fan. I teach tap myself, and I try to keep the traditional routines alive of the vaudeville era. There was a time when television came to you in the form of the vaudeville stage, and I suppose in a lot of ways this is a love letter to that time.
Now, tell our listeners about the character that you've created, this
Ginger Brûlé.
Ginger Brûlé. That's the nom de danse.
Yes, that is my nom de danse. Ginger Brûlé. Well, when I started considering the idea of investigating burlesque as a form in which to interrogate the performance of femininity, I wondered, well, who am I? Who is my character? There are very, very few burlesque performers who use their own names. In fact, Julie Atlas Muse is the only one I know of personally. Generally, the name is created often as a pun, like Dirty Martini, or referencing something about the performer's personality. I decided to go with Ginger because I am a great fan of tap dancing. That goes without saying. But also because my hair is red. Brulé came actually from this idea.
And it's spelled like creme brulee.
Like creme brulee, yes.
The French word, yes.
The French word, yes, which actually means to burn. But I think that something happened when I left the stage to become a homemaker and mother, and that was that I surrounded myself with an almost fetishized domesticity. I cooked. I created these lavish parties. I learned to make, to sort of devour Julia Child, if you will.
I'm sure your spouse was delighted.
He was delighted. It was, yeah, I wouldn't mind being married to me, actually. But there's a darker side to that, yeah. Which is that that sort of single-minded focus on only one kind of creativity came at a cost. And so the notion of Ginger Brulé, Voulez-vous Brulé, is that my character Ginger Brulé is asking some questions, like, do you want to burn? In other words, by presenting myself and my dancers in this particular sort of way, I am indeed inviting a rather conservative community to question whether this is an appropriate representation of a woman, and a woman in particular who is a mother.
And the term brulé in French, I checked with one of my friends who teaches French, and she says it can mean passion.
Yes.
It can mean desire.
Yes.
In French.
Yes.
So a very, very careful choice.
Coup de foudre, yeah. If you will.
So what does a modern-day feminist, married, mother of children, why are you involved in a process to turn people on?
Well, for a number of reasons. That's a hard question to answer with a pat response. But I
and you went into dance maybe so you wouldn't have to talk, right?
Oh no, that's not true. That's an entirely different story.
Another issue, but there is something
issue.
To the fact that people need to see a performance,
yes.
To experience what
yes.
You're trying to do. And to talk
oh,
about it is very much second level.
Yes, it is. But to answer your earlier question, I think this notion of turning people on is more to do with awakening people, awakening them in more ways than just simply the erotic, which I find that the real nature of burlesque is about the conceal, not the reveal.
Wow.
And we are inundated with images of men and women, and at any moment any person can find whatever image they happen to want to see. But the whole fun of burlesque is what you don't see, not what you do. And in this performance, we have a fan dance a la Sally Rand, the wonderful burlesque performer who danced with two gigantic white
or pink
ostrich feather fans. And the whole point was that you almost got to see something, but you never really did. So I think that we're all, as a society, sort of hungry not only for to see more, but also to see less.
Let me interrupt the good discussion we're having about feminism and dance with our guest today, Ginger Brulé. Oh, no. It's Sonia Warfel, who has created this character that will be performing at the Canopy Club as part of her master's thesis performance that she has choreographed, and you will be dancing in as well?
I will be dancing in it as well, but let me clarify.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Technically, my master's thesis will be performed in one of the rehearsal studios at Krannert Center, but this material was developed as part of my master's thesis.
Right. Which comes first?
The first one is on March 5th, and that's at Krannert Center, and it will be in the dance rehearsal room on the second floor on the west side.
And is that open to the public,
it
too?
It is open to the public, too.
In case people can't
too.
Come to the
yes,
17th?
That is open to
what
the public.
Time will that be?
7:30
p.m. So you have two performances, but the only ones your professors will be grading you on is the first.
The first, okay. Yes.
And so why did you choose? Well, I should tell our listeners, this program is pre-recorded before its actual broadcast date because of my schedule and Sonia's, but as a result of that, we will not be able to have questions live on the air during this interview. I apologize for that. I know listeners would enjoy asking questions as well. And my voice isn't at its best today, so I would have appreciated having listeners to ask some questions too. But
well, Steve, might I invite anyone who would like to ask me a question to contact me via my website? I'd be happy to answer any questions that way.
And that website again is Sonia Warfel, WARFEL.com, and you can find contact information, including a email number or email address there. But that's very gracious of you to do that. How do you find being a public person in a small town doing something that some would find offensive?
You know, it's part of the fun, and it's also part of the anxiety of this entire production. My beloved mother and father-in-law have not yet decided if they're going to come, and that is a decision that I leave to them.
Sure.
I still feel very strongly about the work that I'm doing, and I'm interested in sort of bringing just a tiny taste of some of the work that's going on in the bigger cities.
Around the world,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Did you grow up loving to dance? Did you dance
Absolutely.
As a child?
Absolutely.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Alabama, raised in Oregon, and schooled in New York City.
How long did you live in Alabama?
First 10 years.
Oh. And when you went to college, did you know that you wanted dance to be a career?
Absolutely. I went to a performing arts high school. I was very fortunate to go to an exceptional performing arts high school in Portland, Oregon, Jefferson High School for the Performing Arts, where I was able to study with just tremendously exceptional teachers and choreographers. I was part of a touring ensemble that traveled up and down the West Coast. So by the time I graduated from high school, I was 100% invested in dance performance and choreography. So I went to NYU as a dance major, and it's a conservatory school. So I really didn't do anything but dance.
And you have had a professional career that's rather extensive for someone rather relatively young.
Thank you.
Us about that.
Well, I've done a lot of different things. I've done some fun things like dancing with Tony Bennett in a video, Steppin' Out with Tony Bennett. That was a fun thing. And I've also toured Europe and performed as a circus clown and as a modern dancer in New York, lots of different things. So.
And where did you meet your spouse, Andy?
Oh, at NYU. I was fortunate enough to find out that this handsome young man was the designer for a dance that I was in. And we've been together ever since.
Now, tell us about the collaboration between the two of you on this performance that's coming up. He's the production designer, I read?
Yes, he is the production designer, the set designer, the lighting. Audio designer. No, he's not the lighting designer. He's the graphics designer. He is my partner 100% in everything.
And how does he feel about this, or should I interview him next week?
You're welcome to try to get on his schedule. He's going to be in Japan, actually. Well, he supports me 100% in this project. If anything, I think he's really pushed me to go further than anyone else. He's always really challenged me creatively, and I think my best work, and I hope some of his best work is because we work together.
I know if listeners were able to call in and ask questions, they'd be much too polite to ask whether you have a fiery relationship, because two creative people in similar
we're pretty harmonious. I must say, I think we're one of the happiest couples I know.
So, is your husband a feminist?
I don't think he would describe himself as a feminist. No. No, I think he's got too much of a ironic sense of humor to allow himself to be pigeonholed small a word. Yeah.
And what about you?
Absolutely. I was born, raised, bred, breathed feminism from my earliest memories. I remember listening to Free to Be You and Me. I remember receiving my first copy of Our Bodies, Ourselves when I was 10 years old. I remember marching on Washington more times than I can count. So, yes, I have a profound fondness for the second wave and a profound respect for the first. But I find myself solidly in the third. I think that we are a much more complex group of people. I think that the third wave is much more inclusive, and I appreciate that.
I'm familiar, of course, with those descriptions of first, second, third wave feminism in the American and European context, but I keep thinking of Lysistrata and early biblical, very strong female characters.
Yes.
who were pressing the boundaries and imagining very creatively ways to exist as full human beings in their time and places, often in very patriarchal societies.
Yes.
I found it interesting in your thesis description that you talked about the two powers, the separation of church and state, in your description. Are you yourself religious?
I am. I'm an Episcopalian, a practicing one.
And that's a variety of Christianity.
Yes.
Sort of Protestant, sort of Catholic, sort of something.
Some people say the via media, the middle road, as it were, between Catholicism and Protestantism. If you came to a service at my church, Emmanuel Memorial Episcopal, it would be very familiar if you were a Roman Catholic, in the sense that the services are very traditional and follow a very traditional structure. The music is beautiful. There's organ. There's high mass with incense. And there's a certain theatricality to it that I think appeals to me in particular as a performer.
And would you say the liturgy in an Episcopal church is often carefully choreographed?
Absolutely. Everything. My husband actually jokes about the choreography because, you know, it's stand, sit, kneel, stand, sit, kneel.
Does the spirituality that you experience in a Episcopal liturgy on a Sunday morning, does that help you at all as a choreographer, as a dancer?
I would say yes. It's an orbiting back to to my center, I think. And that's why it's important to me. It's also very important, and it's, I think, perhaps even more than my self-care, I take on the role of educating my children in my family's traditional religion very seriously. My grandparents, all four of them, were cradle Episcopalians. However, my father and mother in the 60s became Zen Buddhists. So I have a bit of a mix in there, that meditation and prayer. But also the, every Christmas and Easter was in an Episcopal church. So
we're about halfway through our Keeping the Faith program today. We've been talking with Sonia Warfel, a Master of Fine Arts candidate at the University of Illinois in the Department of Dance. We've been talking about her thesis project, which will be performed at the University and Krannert Center on the 5th of March at 7:30, and about that's open to the public, but there's also a specifically public performance. Will they be identical, by the way?
They will not be identical.
Okay. They're a little bit different.
They're a little bit different, yes. Much of the excitement that I hope to generate with the performance at the Canopy Club involves this idea that we will be transforming the audience in many ways into the performance itself by creating this fun, fantastical cabaret dance party, really. Not dissimilar to perhaps a Moulin Rouge kind of feel.
And that will cost $5. That's the Canopy Club on the 17th. The Canopy Club is in Urbana on Goodwin.
Yes, I believe it's $5 now, but I think it'll be $10 if you wait too long.
Oh, well.
You might want to get your ticket sooner than later.
Very good. And again, soniawarfel.com is a place to go to find out about that and order tickets if you'd like. Coming up on Keeping the Faith in the weeks ahead, let me... He was a resident of Gaza and has been a medical doctor for both Palestinians and Israelis. His three daughters were killed in a shelling of Gaza. He wrote this book since then and has been working to try to work for peace in that very troubled part of the world. So that'll be an interview on February 13. He'll also be speaking several places in Champaign-Urbana that weekend. Professor Brant Houston will be our guest on Keeping the Faith February 20, talking about research he and graduate students are doing on poverty in Champaign County. Professor Houston holds a named chair here at the University of Illinois in the Department of Media. February 27, Elizabeth Buckley will be talking about the value of music. On March 6, Clayton Doffenbaugh will be talking on issues of ecology. And on March 13, Joel Green and Lib Caldwell are two professors in the seminaries, Fuller Seminary for Joel Green and McCormick Seminary for Lib Caldwell. They've both been involved in the translation of the Common English Bible, which is coming out just this year. The New Testament is already out and published, but the whole Bible will be coming out in 2011. So those are some of the programs coming up on Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, your usual host, and happy today to be talking with Sonia Warfel about values and feminism and dance. Sonia, when you were growing up in Alabama, you were growing up Episcopalian, you said, but that's Southern Baptist country.
Yeah, they called us the Whiskeypalians.
Right.
There's a pretty broad community of Episcopalians down there. Although I'm still a little bit sad to see that so much of Southern churches is still so much are so segregated, and sure. segregated not only by race, but really by social standing or
class, education. Sure.
Yeah.
That happens not only in the American South. I'm afraid it's true around the world, but it's one of the issues in religious organizations, that's for sure. When did you first encounter feminist thought? When did you start reading feminists? You said earlier you...
I grew up in it, yeah. I think I don't remember a time when I wasn't engaged with the notion of feminist thought.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
No, I'm an only child.
Was your mother a model for you?
No, I don't think so. Not so much. But there were a lot of really interesting women in my life. I should correct myself. I have a half-brother and a sister as an adult.
And whose ideas influenced you the most as you studied and read and grew and developed in terms of feminism?
Well, I'd have to say I hate to say it, but I think I'm a bit of an autodidact there. Of the people who have influenced me most in my life, I would say my husband. He's the person with whom I engage the most in terms of my learning and my research.
Huh. How did you develop the character of Ginger Brûlé?
A lot of it was in conversation with Andy.
Huh.
Yeah. But also in the dance studio, obviously, figuring out what, you know, the idea of burlesque really is not simply striptease. On the contrary, to burlesque something is to make a mockery.
Okay.
To send up, really, is what it means. So Ginger Brûlé, you know, what does she send up? What is she satirizing or making comment upon? Well, the performance of motherhood, the performance of housewifery. That's what I hope she will be interrogating in this performance.
Now, you say interrogating, so there are – you're not giving answers, you're asking questions.
I would hope I don't have the answers yet. If I'm still in my thesis project, I think I'm still asking the questions. Perhaps by the end of the semester, I will have drawn some conclusions, but
– You're already teaching, though. Tell
yes.
us what you teach.
I primarily teach tap dance, and I love it. And I teach with my collaborator, who is an amazing, amazing dancer, who's also in the performance, Jordan Chevelle.
That's a male or female?
A guy, yeah.
Okay.
Male. He's an undergraduate in his senior year in advertising,
huh.
of all things.
How did you meet him?
He came to one of my classes.
Huh.
And he was so exceptional. I couldn't teach him anything. So I ended up becoming a student.
And after you get this master's degree, what are you going to be doing after that?
I hope to teach. I really do.
What level?
I'm interested in teaching high school level, but I'm also very interested in at the university level.
Okay. When you first came to the University of Illinois, who came here first? Did you get the position in the graduate school, or did Andy get the position at Krannert, or how did that all work?
Uncustomarily, neither.
Ah.
Andy and I were living in New York City for 12 years before we moved here, and we made the move as a direct result of the events of 9/11. I was at home with a toddler, and he was on a job. And everything changed. Everything in New York changed. Not the least of which was that our business failed. We weren't the only ones. And it called into question all of our choices. And we decided as a family, I should also note that I discovered that I was pregnant with our second child and very happy about it, that we needed to regroup. And our intention was to drive west and set up a house on the West Coast in Portland, where I'm from. But we wanted to spend a little time with his family. Our 20s had been a very fast-paced, hard-working
New York City. In
New York City. And he just hadn't had enough time to spend with his grandparents or his parents. And so we came back to the old family farm in Tolono with his mother and father. And they graciously let us live there for a good year, perhaps more, and just regroup. And then once we'd been here for a while, we realized that we liked it. And also I was so glad to have gotten to know Professor Sarah Hook, who is a professor at the Department of Dance. And she invited me to come take a dance class. And it had been quite a long time since I had danced. See, I'd made the mistake in thinking that a career in performance or even in the study of dance was incompatible with parenting. And so I'd been out of the studio for a long, long time. I was terrified, absolutely terrified, but she talked me into it. And so I came and I took one dance class. And the best way I can describe it is, for those of your listeners who've traveled before, if you spend a long time in a foreign country and then you sit in a cafe and you hear your own language spoken, that's what it felt like to go back into the studio. It felt like coming home. But not home to some physical place on the map, but to a society of like-minded people.
So now, was this after the birth of your second child or while you were still pregnant?
This is after the birth of our second child, yes. So that's when I decided to apply for the master's program here.
You mentioned a business you and Andy were doing in New York City. What was that?
My husband is a production designer, primarily set design for corporate events, trade shows, things like that. And so his business really did depend upon corporate travel, which completely stopped, as we all remember.
Sure. Right after 9/11.
That's right.
But now he's doing what?
Same thing. Andy Warfel Environment Design is his company. He does set design and production design, among many other things, writes as well, creative director. And he is not associated with the university, but we have our own corporation.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Although he does do some work in town. Most of the work that he does, he travels for. And with the exception of the Champaign-Urbana Ballet, with whom he has been closely working for many years now.
Let me reintroduce our guest for those who may have joined the program late. And, of course, if you missed part of this, you can catch it via your computer by going to will.illinois.edu/keepinthefaith. And this program will be archived in just a few days or a week or so. Also, of course, all prior programs going back many years are there for you to enjoy at your convenience. Again, that's will.illinois.edu/keepinthefaith. Coming up at the University Y, which supports this program and has for a number of years, at the Friday Forum on the 11th of February, part of their series on Americans at War, a look at the impacts of U.S. military power in the 21st century. On the 11th, the talk will be by William Gorin, who's director of the Center for Advancement of Sustainability Innovations of the U.S. Army, talking about another shade of green for the U.S. Army. Then on the 18th, Kathy Kelly, who's coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, will be speaking on prophetic voice, public witness, searching for a nonviolence approach. Two in a series of, I guess, about eight different talks at the University Y on the University of Illinois campus on Friday noons. They're free and open to the public. you'd like to order lunch in advance, you could call the Y at 217-337-1500, or you could do like I did today and just walk in and say, may I order lunch, and they can always find it for you. So that's at 1001 South Wright Street at the University YMCA on Friday noons. The Know Your University lecture series will begin on the 22nd of February with a Midsummer Night's Dream. It's a Bacchanal with a professor from the theater department, Lisa Gay Dixon. We'll be talking about that on the first of the Know Your University lectures. Those are on Tuesday noons at the University Y. Currently, there's an art show at that Y called Ability, an exhibition of the artwork of Swan Special Care Center residents, children and older folks who have very severe disabilities, but who can express themselves very effectively, in some cases with visual art. And that'll be at the Y until February 18. The next Art at the Y show will be starting February 24th and will last till the 1st of April. And that'll be a 23 Portraits by Jason Patterson. These are new works that portray influential African-American women with roots in the Champaign-Urbana and University of Illinois communities. And again, that art show will begin on February 24th with an exhibition opening Thursday the 24th at 7 o'clock, again at the University of YMCA, 1001 South Wright. Well, getting back to our guest, Sonia Warfel, we're talking about feminism and dance and spirituality. Words really can't describe dance, and yet we're trying to talk about it. Who are some of the people that people might have seen the results of their choreography that are important to you as a choreographer?
Well, I think many of your listeners will be familiar with the golden age of the MGM musical. Fell out of fashion, of course, for a while in the 70s, but I've always been a student of those amazingly virtuosic performers and choreographers, the Fred Astaire's and the Gene Kelly's, the Sid Charisse. There's so many I couldn't even begin to name them. But this performance, Ginger Brulé Presents Voulez-Vous Brulé, does indeed pay homage to those icons.
Tell us, after you got the idea in consultation with Andy, as you've described, of this character, Ginger Brulé, who portrays her in this project?
Well, she makes a bit of a journey. I am Ginger Brulé in the performance itself, but she begins, I sort of share the role with another performer, as perhaps my younger self, and that performer is the one that you see on the posters.
And how did you develop the character? What went into the thinking of? I have no idea what's involved in creating a character that's presented in movement.
Well, I suppose it's not dissimilar to the way that one goes about writing a character. You simply make an appointment with yourself and practice your craft. And for me and for my dancers, that means getting together in a dance studio and experimenting and playing. And I directed my dancers and myself to indulge in pure frivolity and camp and even stereotype, because of course a burlesque is a caricature. It is an amplification, if you will, of certain characteristics. So a lot of it is moving around. As a group, selected several different pieces of music. We sort of auditioned music by playing it in the studio and seeing what sort of kinds of movement we felt ourselves drawn towards once the music was on. If it's sort of a fast-paced, bouncy sort of tune, we may be doing something that resembles a tap dance routine, even if we're not wearing tapped shoes. If it's a, for example, there is a tune in the production called "Keep Young and Beautiful." I'm not sure if you're familiar with it.
I don't know it.
Let's see if I can pull this off. Keep young and beautiful. It's your duty to be beautiful. Keep young and beautiful if you want to be loved. Well, there's a lot of information in that song. And
Who wrote it?
I'm sorry. I can't remember. I'll have to look that up. But it's Eddie Cantor was the one who recorded it in a Busby Berkeley movie that I happened to come across. And it was also recently recorded by Annie Lennox.
Huh.
I found it the meanest song ever. And I just fell in love with it because it precisely for that reason. And when I watched the Eddie Cantor clip in the Busby Berkeley movie, it was horrifying, utterly horrifying. It was, dare I say, even fascist.
Huh.
And I looked at when the film was produced, and it was the same year that Dachau was opened. So there's a lot of weighty questions I'm asking. I don't know how much has changed really between now and then with in terms of our expectation for women. And this notion of our obligation to keep young and beautiful as if that's somehow a choice.
Uh-huh.
So that those sorts of questions are being asked in this dance performance. And
so you deal with issues of age?
Absolutely, yes. Uh-huh. And the physical limitations that come, my dancer who plays the character of Gigi is absolutely amazing. She can kick her leg higher than you can imagine. She can spin. She can bend over backwards. And on top of that, she's just absolutely beautiful to boot.
What's her age range?
She is a senior in undergraduate school. And so she is who I was, I imagine, 20 years ago. And so I think that the notion of the passage of time is definitely part of this performance.
Are there any older dancers in the show?
Myself.
So you're dealing with issues of age. What other issues from a feminist perspective will people encounter?
I would say confinement. There is a pretty fabulous set piece that my adoring husband has built for me that is a 14-foot Victorian birdcage. And I don't want to give away too much, but I think the image of, we talked earlier about this quotation, there are women who make of themselves a nosegay, a cage of birds. I think that I think I fell victim to that impulse when I first decided to take on motherhood and housewifery. I created a caricature of the perfect wife and mother. And I don't think I'm alone in trying to do that. And so I think confinement, seclusion, the public versus the private, certainly.
I remember when my spouse first... She's a scientist, and I remember when she first gave a paper in a professional meeting back in the, I suppose it would have been in the 60s, maybe early 70s, And at the time in her field of microbiology, there were very few females. And she was in a long line of men who went up to the speaker's stand, and there was a lavalier microphone that for years the custom was the man who had just finished giving his talk on his discoveries would take the lavalier off his neck and he'd reach around and put it around the neck of the next man who was to speak, you know, who was there. And when the Asian man who spoke before my wife realized he'd have to put his arms around her before, you know, to attach the microphone at the back of her neck. And here he was putting his arms around an attractive young woman in an attractive outfit. It wasn't particularly revealing, but it was feminine. And he had his arms around her. He started, he says, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. And he was saying it into the mic, of course, which was between them.
Yeah.
But there are all kinds of issues that women have had to face in those kind of situations.
And I am so glad that we get to face those issues. I am so glad that I am in a position today, thanks to the hard-won efforts of previous generations, to study and to ask these sorts of questions and to perform.
Now, you were working with a woman professor, Sarah Hook. I know when I was in graduate school, my professor was very helpful to me, but he, of course, insisted that I do this project on my own. It was a writing project.
Mm-hmm. There is a writing aspect to my project
as well.
Yes, a paper. Mm-hmm.
But in dance, how separate can a professor be when you're developing a program like this?
Well, I think there's always mentorship. Uh-huh. It is our obligation as the students to get as much as we can from our professors. But we regularly meet to discuss our projects. All of the graduate students together do that. And we also schedule showings of the work in progress so that we can get feedback.
Okay. And when you and Professor Hook are discussing these things, are you involved in other projects, or is this really what you almost totally focus on once you finished your coursework?
Well, she obviously has many other projects and many other students. But for myself, I am 100% invested in this project.
Okay.
I do teach as well, but...
But that's private and independent of the university? Or
I'm teaching a tap dance class right now
at the
university.
Yes. I see. Okay. Do you have private students as well?
No.
But maybe in the future.
Well, I don't know. Honestly, it has been a really amazing and interesting challenge to balance working, teaching, and parenting all at the same time.
Yeah. How old are your children?
My son is 11 and my daughter is 8.
Do either of them dance?
Yes, my daughter dances.
Let's talk about balancing, the balancing act of parents and kids and professions and studies. A lot of people at the university have to do that. Any advice? What have you learned?
I think patience has been really important for me. I think it's actually been easier for me in a lot of ways than some of my peers. I see the other graduate students, they jump in with both feet. They leave a life someplace else. And for 3 years, they live in a completely unknown or previously unknown place without their support structure sometimes. And so school is everything for them. But for me, I have my family here. And because I had this protracted schedule of a 5-year process as opposed to a 3-year process, I think I was able to manage it as well as could be expected. Mm-hmm. I can't say there weren't times when I was utterly overwhelmed by the intensity of the scholarship, but it's been so valuable.
And is your spiritual life of help to you in any of that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think it's really a centering thing for me. I think I mentioned that before, this idea of returning to center. And it's also a place where I'm able to connect. I think a lot of the fulfillment that I derive from my relationship with my church is the fellowship. It's in a lot of instances, it's the one place where I reconnect with certain friends, and I really enjoy sharing the rich and just gorgeous tradition of my Big C church with my children and my godchildren.
And does the fact that Christianity emphasizes things like the incarnation, the enfleshment of the divine, does that fit with what you do professionally?
That's a very good question. I'd never thought of it that way. Embodiment is a word that we use a lot in dance. Sometimes I think rather casually. Uh-huh. But to be a fully embodied performer, I think, is to be in that transcendent state of neither thinking of what came before or thinking of what's coming next, but being completely present, an experience that I think many athletes also find and obviously can be found in meditation and prayer.
We're down to our last couple minutes. This is a hard question, but I grew up in a church where we weren't allowed to dance. This was a very evangelical, fundamentalist church where my grandfather was pastor.
I just can't think of anything more sad.
I went to a college where we signed a statement saying we would not dance or drink alcohol or smoke tobacco or whatever for our 4 years while we were in school. What did I miss? Incidentally, when I was in seminary, I went to Arthur Murray and took classes.
Sure. Joy. Oh. I'm sure you experienced joy, but for me, there is nothing more joyful. I mean, if you've ever watched a child frolicking in the sun, that's dancing, you know, running around in circles or spinning till you just feel that sort of welling up of joy. I think that's what dance is really about.
When the sacred ark was brought back to Jerusalem at one point, King David was so ecstatic that the Bible describes him as dancing mm-hmm. in a very abbreviated costume, which mm-hmm. offended one of his wives.
Yes. I do know that passage.
Know that story.
Yes, yeah. I do. There's quite a bit of dancing in the Bible.
There is. And, of course, there's the ecstatic experience of the Holy Spirit in the New Testament. And there are churches which celebrate that with Pentecostal churches with mm-hmm. dance.
Yes, they do.
Dancing in the Spirit.
Yes.
Well, I've enjoyed the conversation. I'm sorry. Again, I apologize, listeners, for not letting you ask questions this week. But we've had to pre-record this because of our various schedules. But I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host of these programs. Our guest today has been Sonia Warfel. That's Warfel. And if you'd like to learn more about her various performances and when they'll be available to be seen, you may go to soniawarfel.com and look out for that information. And if listeners would like to ask her questions, she's graciously said you can go to her website and send her emails, and she'll respond to you there. Next week on Keeping the Faith, I'm happy to be interviewing, the author of I Shall Not Hate, a Palestinian physician whose daughters were killed in the conflict in Gaza. We'll be talking with him on February 13, February 20, Professor Brant Houston, about poverty in Champaign County. Thanks for listening to Keeping the Faith.